Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Thursday, the 14th of May. Very nice to have you all with us. A great pleasure as always, and we welcome you to sit in, listen to what we have to say about various issues, and even participate. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, good morning, Big Joe. I'm still leveling off after that wonderful fun drive, which you were so important to. I mean, you know, the partnerships and the way that you did it and the way that we all did it together is just extraordinary. So it takes me more than a day to come down from that kind of a high.
Absolutely. Well, it was a good day, and we thank we certainly thank everybody. Yeah, it's just an amazing thing. And you know, if you still want to help out, you still can. If you feel like you missed it, well, we still need money.
Well, we do. And Joe, just seriously, as you know, we budget based on pre-corona. So have we been hit very hard? We've been hit very hard. We were hit on the Linda Norris Auditorium. We haven't been, you know, that's costing WMC a lot of money because usually money comes in from those performances and other things. And then also our underwriting program is getting back in gear real hard right now. I just saw a $13,000 contract, but it's still behind. So if anybody wants to say, okay, WAMC, you're my station, I want to help, stick it in an envelope and send it to us at WAMC 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Back to you, Joe.
All right. Thank you very much, Alan. We want to welcome our panel to the group here and to our airwaves, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, quite a mouthful, Jim Hendler is here. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Joe. Nice to be back.
It's great. It's great you're here. And every time you come on and Joe talks about the Tetherless, I think this is the year I'm going to get myself a tetherball outside here. So I
you
want
know,
you to
you
know
what you're
doing.
You can stand 6 feet apart and play.
That's
yeah,
a very good
absolutely.
Point. Absolutely. You have to touch the gross ball, but sure, yeah.
There's nothing like, well, you can wear gloves or something, can't
that's
you?
True.
Tetherless
yeah.
gloves.
Yeah. Yes, tetherless yeah. gloves. Artistic.
We sell them cheap.
Yes. Artistic director, CEO of the Berkshire Theater Group, and our dear friend, Kate McGuire. Good morning, Kate. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Congratulations on the fundraiser.
Thank you very much. Thank
You're
you.
You're very welcome.
We are so lucky. We're so lucky to have Kate with us. You know, she is the best of the best of the best, and we really love her. She's been a big asset to the Berkshires for all of these years. How's it all going, Kate? Are you going to be able to stay alive?
The times are challenging, aren't they? Really challenging, especially for those, well, not especially, especially for everyone. But those of us in the arts are having a tough time. We can't do our work on our stages. And, you know, actors, when they're not working, are generally waiting on tables. So that's a double whammy for a lot of folks right now. But we will persevere, and we're waiting to hear what the governor has to say on the 18th. And we keep trying to figure out what we can do, changing plans like everyone else, moment to moment.
Well, we will... With that in mind, we're going to be talking a lot about opening and when to and when not to throughout our conversation this morning, so I'm sure we'll talk more about that. We also welcome Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Carius-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. Well, the sun is shining, so it can't be all bad. I'm trying to have a little bit of a positive spin this morning.
Okay. How's that going for you?
Well, I just looked at the unemployment numbers that were filed for this week, so maybe not so much, but I'm still trying.
Yes. The new unemployment numbers came out, and we're grim. We'll get to that in a second as well. Again, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear what you have to say on what's going on in our world. And again, it's panel at WAMC.org. We just ask that you keep your letter short and to the point, and you don't add attachments or use abbreviations. And, oh, this is just a helpful little hint. Please proofread, because we want to make sure that what you meant to say is actually what you say. All right. Wisconsin justices strike down stay-at-home extension. What does this mean? The Supreme Court's conservative majority sided with Republican legislators and struck down the decision by the Democratic governor, Tony Evers' administration, to extend a stay-at-home order intended to quell the spread of the novel coronavirus. So you have a governor who says, okay, we're going to extend the stay-at-home order because we feel we are not at the place where we should be to open up in a safe manner. Then the Republican lawmakers say, no, you've gone too far. We have to get the economy back to normal. They take it to court. The Supreme Court strikes down the stay-at-home extension. Alan, what do we make of it?
Well, this has been from the first day that this guy gets elected governor, he's a Democrat, they've been trying to bring him down. Now, what's the public going to think? We have a Democratic governor who wants to protect our lives, and we have these other guys who say open it up at all costs and bring it to the courts. And the courts, comply with what the Republicans want. However, I think that they may be, in fact, creating a little bit of a problem for themselves. That's what I'm thinking.
In a problem in the sense of if there are spikes and it really turns out to be a bad idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Jim Henler.
You know, it's so puzzling. You know, I heard a nice interview with the Wisconsin governor last night, and it's now goes down to a county by county while they try to work something out. And he says it's at least 2 to 3 weeks while they do it. So, you know, you have counties right next to each other where one has the bars open and one has, you know, a stay-at-home order. And, you know, it's clearly not going to work. And, you know, this craziness, we've been doing a lot of projections. I know one of my colleagues, Malik, has been on the done a few interviews with you guys on our predictive analytics that he's been doing. And when you look at these county-by-county numbers and get into this craziness where everybody can, and the guy next to them can be completely different, it's going to be very complicated to see what happens, but all of the projections show numbers going up. So basically, Wisconsin Supreme Court says we're going to follow the law and we're going to kill people.
So how could that be the law? I mean, I guess I don't under in legal principle, what is that? So they're saying what goes too far?
So as I understand it, and of course, I'm not a lawyer, I don't even play one on TV, but the lawyers on
the radio
TV said, but the lawyers on TV shows said that essentially what the Supreme Court did was they narrowly interpreted something that said they basically said the legislature and the executive branch must together do this. It cannot be an executive branch function to continually use the emergency power. So they said there's a limit to how long the governor could rule in an emergency. And you could see where there could be times where that makes sense. However, in this particular case, it seems like they're doing it very slow. You know, they put real constraints on it in a way that will make it very hard. So they could have said the governor only has this much more time or things like that. Instead, they just said completely, nope, you know, we're ruling all of that's out back to the legislator. And these are the same people who made people go out and vote. And, you know, a chunk of those voters got sick and passed them on to other people. So I really have trouble understanding the lack of empathy among so many of these people who are making these decisions.
Well, isn't it just political? I mean, this is just one more time that the Republicans in Wisconsin are banding together and saying if the Democratic governor wants it, no matter how right he is, we're going to oppose it.
Seems like. And, you know, I don't talk about it much, but a few years ago when we did all this, when we did all the statistics of all the states after the election, the one state where you could really see that the Republican voter suppression made, you could prove it made the difference, was Wisconsin.
Yeah.
That legislature is doing everything it can to be as Republican as it can and to help Trump in every way they can.
Vera?
Yeah, on another thought, I think it's obviously deeply political when you reflect on the arguments related to executive overreach. Those arguments apparently are never used in relation to the federal government and the Trump administration. But here you have a Democratic governor who, by state law and public health law, has a right to make the best decision for the common good in terms of this particular coronavirus health risk for the public. But here the argument is, oh, this must be clearly executive overreach by this governor of Wisconsin because he's a Democrat. Similar kinds of decisions are not made against Republican governors when they make decisions that benefit the Republican administrations and especially the federal government. So the overreach argument is used in different ways by Republicans, depending on the context of the state, and therefore we can also see how political it really is.
Kate.
Well, that's such a good point, Vera, I think. I feel like we're living in times that we're just being tossed upside down, and there's no middle ground. And as Alan constantly says, the times are dangerous. The rule of law is being turned upside down all the time. And at this particular time, a time of fear, we are living in even more confusion and upset, I think. It is a dangerous time.
I agree with you. That's a really good point, because during times of fear, anybody who advances arguments in favor of law and order and rigidity and control, like Republicans often advance, tend to benefit. So what they're trying to do is use an old playbook in terms of frightening the general public about disorder. And that's also what a lot of the demonstrators are doing when they're out in public and menacing and suggesting that this is government overreach and control of their private sphere and their life in public and their opportunity to work. This is really an attempt to manipulate emotions and make people afraid of what the government can do to their personal freedom.
So what's the outcome going to look like? I mean, here's Kate, who has this wonderful theater festival and the Colonial Theater one in Stockbridge, one in Pittsfield, and she can't bring anybody in. It's got to be very frustrating. On the other hand, as Governor Cuomo keeps saying, you know, death is a very bad thing. And if my choice is between having people dying or keeping things closed in certain areas, you know, I know what I'm going to do. But I can see people who take either side of this thing for a good reason. The idea that you can't work and you can't put food on your table and you can't feed your kids and you can't do this and that is pretty powerful. What do you do? And that appeals to the people.
Well, the outcome will come, won't it, when there are treatments and we can get a vaccination. So that will happen. What happens in the interim and how we get through November, which seems even more critical, but the head of state is not wearing a mask and the rest of us are all wearing masks. I mean, it's quite a metaphor, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. In essence, this summer, though, don't you think people are really in the Berkshires in this area, Hudson Valley? Aren't people ready to go out and about? And can there be public theater performances out in the open if there's sort of a temporary stage and if chairs are, you know, disseminated in a wider variety so that you sit farther apart. Is there a way to do some theater?
I'm sure you've been thinking about that. Kate.
Yeah, what we're looking at is putting up a tent on the grounds in Stockbridge with a stage and seating spatially distanced. That seems to me to be the position that we can take that people will feel most comfortable in, at least today. If we are able to go into the Fitzpatrick main stage, our old playhouse that has been around for almost 100 years, if we're allowed to go in there, then we're going to take the permanent seating out and place chairs every day in different positions according to the number of people that want to come. The inside situation, we'll see where we get to, but having an outdoor stage feels a little more possible to me. The Colonial certainly is a huge space, and we can socially distance, but you know, we're in the world of looking at the filters on our air conditioners and how do we bring people safely indoors. And so much will depend on what the governor says, what people continue to say, and how we monitor. Because it's not, you know, it's the audience, it's the actors, it's the crews backstage, so it's the dressing rooms. So we're putting as much into play and gathering as much information in a thoughtful way, we hope. And we'll be ready when someone says go.
All right. We have to take a break. We're just, yes, it is certainly a struggle. We have to take a break. We'll talk more about this. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we'll continue after this short break. Talk Jim Handler, Kate McGuire, and Vera Acarias-Kelly. We welcome your letters, your questions for our panel, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So as we look at this issue of Wisconsin, and Alan, you brought this up, I mean, it does bring us to the point of, okay, but what do we do next? And as far as these big questions that everybody has of, you know, what is safe, and does this court decision give any precedent to other states where other such measures are going to be challenged?
Well, I think a great deal is going to have to do with what the state laws look like, Joe, and the state constitutions look like. Wisconsin has always had, as you know, I know a lot about this because I wrote a book about Wisconsin, but it's never changed. It's fiercely competitive between the Republicans and the Democrats. And it's interesting because there's this sort of right-wing Democratic thing. Nixon staffed his White House with Wisconsin people, Jarvis Leonard and so many other people. And the left, David Obie and people like that from the old days, he became a congressman later on, they were on the left side. So this has been going on for a long time, and it is just about the way it is in Wisconsin. But each state obviously has a different set of norms. I think that that's true.
When you have what you're seeing, I guess, Jim, of all the protests and happening at state capitals across the country, I mean, we can only assume there will be more court action, but you wonder what effect that ultimately will have, especially as Alan so rightly mentioned early on that, you know, unfortunately, the barometer of all of this is going to be the death toll.
You know, I think the death toll is one thing. I think, you know, I look at how a lot of this stuff is going to impact what happens in November with the election. We already have courts that are starting to rule that if it's possible to have in-person elections, then you cannot have, you know, people who can make it to the polls can't be allowed to mail in. Again, that varies by state, by county, so it stuns me that something as important as virus has become so political and is playing out against this political backdrop when we're looking at a crisis. You know, I obviously wasn't around in the Great Depression, but it causes me to wonder, was there the same kind of insane politics going on back there where, you know, you had people, tons of people in food lines and things like that, and, you know, parts of the government trying to fix it and parts of the government saying, no, it's personal rights and things. But you really see the values playing out. But as you say, the ultimate value is how many people are we willing to lose?
How uniquely American is this, Vera, in the sense of, if only we had a comparative political scientist on the program. How American is this as far as this idea? I mean, we're even hearing in China of people who, you know, okay, we go back and then we realize, oh, we shouldn't have done that, and we don't see maybe the court action, of course, in a country like that, but we certainly do see this back and forth.
So I wanted to make a couple of comments on that. Namely, I'm familiar with some of the sort of more public attitudes displayed in the upper Midwest because I used to live in Minnesota, a neighboring state to Wisconsin, for several years, for quite a while, actually. I went to college there, undergraduate. So Wisconsin has a very interesting attitude, which I would describe more as a settler mentality, which is something the Trump administration is trying to dip into, this sort of sense that we are people that, you know, we pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, we are responsible individuals, we manage, we work our way through difficulties, we have farms, we have a history of fighting against outsiders who are bringing in trouble. And that is a very different attitude from large urban environments, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York City, where there's a sense that we are a densely, you know, we live in densely populated areas. We need to address public health crises in a particular way to make sure it doesn't spread further. What you find in so this is sort of the attitude that Trump is trying to this is sort of the division, the polarization angle that Trump is trying to dip into, this sort of settler mentality that he likes to appeal to. And it kind of works as long as you don't have massive death tolls. Now, I think there will be backlash in the upper Midwest fairly soon because the Wisconsin situation will be affecting Minnesota. Minnesota is significantly more moderate in comparison to Wisconsin. Now, if you compare what's happening in some of the European countries, I want to point to a study that came out very recently that looked at societies in Eastern Europe that had experienced very intense economic difficulties or were occupied by the Soviets. People in those countries, including Croatia, Slovenia, sort of the former Yugoslav areas, you look at also areas like Greece that fairly recently experienced in 2008 and thereafter deep economic marginalizations. All of those people are managing to adjust quite well to social distancing policies. Why is that? The issue is that in those countries they have been exposed to police state activities in the former Soviet areas. They have been through economic marginalization, unemployment, and extreme difficulties. And they're very focused on staying healthy. They follow rigid regulations, and their death rates are significantly lower. So it's interesting to look at social attitudes in societies and figure out why it is that in some societies people follow public health regulations and are more disciplined versus other societies where they're not. And I think it goes back to sort of a fundamental sense of who you are as a people and what your historical experience has been. And I think we can sort of juxtapose Greek behavior to Wisconsin behavior, for example. Very interesting if you compare those kinds of behaviors in public and the sort of need in the United States to find immediate gratification, to go out there and have fun. And sort of a lot of people have not had the experience with limits to their lives. Now, we know in urban environments that's often different. We have a lot of people that are struggling with poverty for a long time, and maybe there are other reasons for why sometimes people try to circumvent rules and regulations. But there is something fundamentally different about the United States broadly addressed this need to find immediate gratification and the sense to feel a right to be out there, out and about, and enjoy life.
You know, that's really fascinating. There was an article in the New York Times yesterday that I pored over because I just found it. I think this was anecdotal because anybody who was out last week. I mean, I'm coming into work, so I know what it was like several weeks ago when I would pass two cars on my entire trip. And last Friday when I was going home, I actually had traffic. So it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that many more people were out. And the Times had an article yesterday that ran that said, after weeks cooped up at home following governor's orders to contain the coronavirus outbreak, U.S. residents appear eager to get moving again. As some states began to relax restrictions, about 25 million more people ventured outside their homes on an average day last week during the preceding 6 weeks. That, according to cell phone data, that people were out in nearly every part, which is a little scary, even if you think about it. I want to know more about that, Jim Hendler. In nearly every part of the country, the share of people staying home dropped in places by nearly 11 percentage points. And I mean, not to be overly snarky about it, but I just, where are they going if nothing's open yet? I mean, that was the case last week, the data, and I'm talking about here in New York. Yes.
Joe, it is the case that on the warmest, the first day that spring hits in Berkshire County, that is the day of the most car accidents.
Sure, everybody's out right.
Driving recklessly. So it does have something to do with, my God, it's spring. Let's go. Let's get outside. And I get in my car every day now, which I didn't do a couple of weeks ago. But I get in my car now and I just drive around. It's like I've got to be outside at least driving. I'm driving now. I wasn't even driving 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Maybe all these people are just driving that you ran into.
Well, I guess that's fine. Jim?
We're certainly seeing more people in places like parks and things.
Yes.
But what is interesting is at least around where I am, you're still seeing lots of people in masks.
Absolutely.
And keeping social distance and, you know, talking to each other from parts. So it's nice to see people kind of adopting to a social life with social distancing. Joe, if you want to go into the contact tracing apps and the geolocations, that's actually something I've been leading a campus committee on. So I'm
all right. Seeing
that.
Well,
and that's a very interesting one for U.S. versus Europe, when we get there.
Okay, so let's take a break, and when we come back, I am interested in that. I think certainly if you're the expert on this, I think we should talk about it. So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go to that. We have letters, and we welcome yours as well. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this 14th day of May. 47 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Kate McGuire, Vera Carius-Kelly, and Jim Hendler, who we're going to put on the spot now. So right before the break, we were talking about this idea of, I was referencing an article from the New York Times, and it's ultimately from cell phone data. So, Jim, I made passed a remark, as Alan would say, about the fact that, you know, it's a little scary that people know that you're out and about. Should I be scared of that?
So there's really two different things going on here, Joe. One is, so all the time my phone is reporting to my phone maker and to various other people where I am. That's called geolocation data. We won't go into that, but suffice to say that lots of people know where you are all the time.
Right.
The real question is it going back to any kind of government organization? In China, for example, that's not only happening, but that's mandated. So they know where you are all the time, things like that, which is very useful for them in trying to fight a pandemic. It's not so great from a privacy point of view, obviously. In Europe, what's happening is many of these apps are being explored. There's been significant investment in privacy and security. Rules are being propagated. And again, you have national governments that are saying, okay, we're recommending people use this. And here, you know, some of them are open source. You can actually go see what's being reported to whom. In general, there's two kinds of apps. So I have an app on my phone right now that if I spend more than a few minutes close to someone else who is running the same app and somebody self-reports COVID, then I will get an alert that says you were near someone on Tuesday.
What's the name of the app?
I can decide what to do about it. This is an app that is coming from MIT. It's called Private Key. If you look for safe places at MIT, you can find it. However, it's not heavily used at the moment. So, of course, it's not useful until a lot of people use it. There are Android and iOS versions. And again, some of us are just mostly seeing if it works. But the companies like Apple and Google are able to take the actual location data and track some of that. So I have a private app. They have the ability to track more. They have said they will only release that to governments and only under certain conditions and anonymized. So governments can say, hey, we have a hotspot here. We see, there's a large group of people gathering in place X. Whether they will know whether some of those people had COVID or not typically wouldn't be through the app. Now what would happen is a human contact tracer would be able to look at that data and say, oh, you said you were at such and such a park on Tuesday. Wow, we see there were a big group of people there. We'd better dig down into that and see who was bumping things into people or do warnings and things. So once we are starting to reduce social distancing, the two things that seem like they'll be crucial will be testing and this kind of tracing. In Europe, those are being handled by national governments. In the U.S., just like we were talking about before with voting, with releasing social distancing, every county for itself, every state for itself, we have no federal response in this stuff. And so most of the things that could really keep us much safer while we do this reduction, really the more centralized, the more that can be done by a large organization that can keep an eye on it, which ideally would be either the federal government or at least the state government. Not so much looking at where you are, which is the creepy part, but looking in general at where people are and using that to help the people who will be contact tracing. So when you go to the hospital with COVID, they say, hey, where have you been? They will help you find where you've been, who you've been in contact with, and that will help them with the tracing. We are actually looking at something where some of the average time to trace human to human at the moment takes 2 to 3 hours of interviews. With some of this data, it looks like you can get that down to 15, 20 minutes. So what you're really doing is you're going to make it so that you can help the human contact tracers be much more effective.
All right. So we have a letter from Geraldine, and I think she gets sort of to the heart of the matter here. So let me read her letter. I would like to hear you discuss contact tracing because I understand that it is an important tool to control new cases. However, I just don't think that Americans will comply. We've been burned too often by scam artists who want personal information. I can't even see folks being willing to indicate their date of birth, not to mention giving out friends' phone and info. Furthermore, will Americans be willing to stay home without pay even when they are not sick? I hate to see billions being spent on this program when it won't work. What are your thoughts?
Well, how it'll work is remains to be seen. But again, I think the key idea that most of us are working around is that there will primarily be humans in the loop. When you go to a hospital and you've been sick and someone is interviewing you, Right. And then we're building tools for those people. So, again, they don't need 100% compliance. I should make it clear that this app that I have on my phone is what's called a privacy preserving app. So it's kind of complicated to explain how it works. But essentially, when I come in touch with somebody else, our phones know that, but only with little coded blocks. It doesn't say Jim Hendler met Joe Donahue. It said 27347 met 28645. Right. So now what happens is if the one with that, if I were to report that, my phone kind of gets in touch with all the people whose number is there without even really knowing who they are. It just says, hey, you know, you came in contact. So it doesn't say, Joe, you came in contact with Jim Hendler on Tuesday at such and such a location.
So it won't tell me.
So it's a mix of privacy. And not. So it may get more usage because it's easy. It feels personalized and it doesn't really require sharing personal information.
But
so
you go ahead.
I wanted to say that I'm also using an app that's a different app where I self-report on a daily basis, voluntarily how I feel and if I've taken a COVID test. And so you can do this for a household, multiple people in the household, or just for yourself. They do. It's a medical study. It comes out of Massachusetts. Various medical institutions are behind it, and they're trying to figure out if they can get to a certain number of voluntary participants by county, so you get a county self-reporting number whether infections are up or down. And so Albany County is almost at the level where the number is sufficiently high to get specific data on the county. So it's very interesting because every day, every morning I get up and I self-report whether anything has changed about my medical condition and if I have any sort of symptoms that I think might be related to COVID or if I'm feeling fine.
Do you take your temperature every morning, Vera?
No, I just self-report. It's a basic study that asks me, how do I feel? Do I feel normal? Do I have anything that I'm worried about? I can sort of report what my symptoms are. And
oh,
then
that
I
sounds like a really good therapist.
I want that all the time. How are you doing?
Expensive.
Help me breathe.
No, I mean, it's not, you know, it's basically self-reporting. Do I feel normal or do I think I am not? Is something going on?
Oh, God,
right? And then they ask me if I'm
household.
Kate's question is so interesting. Do you take your temperature, you know, every day? The question in my house is, do I take it every hour? So, not only that.
Well, I think, Alan, you would be excluded from the study. They want people to really just provide information that they can then use, whether, you know, to determine perhaps what pre-existing conditions might lead to exposure or further complications. I mean, this is a very general study, and every 30 days, all the data is, you know, I mean, completely anonymized throughout, but it's eliminated from the system and you start over, right?
And let me say that
data point.
Just a real quick point on that. A lot of universities are looking at doing this. So as they reopen, whatever students come back to campus will probably be asked to be doing exactly that kind of self-reporting. It's a very useful way of tracking a known population.
I was not to bore you, but I was at both a doctor appointment and then I had to go to a state facility yesterday. So I had my temperature taken four times in the afternoon. Fine, I didn't have a fever, but the readings were like within a range of like 2.5 degrees, which I found within an hour, which I found really interesting. So
what do you mean?
Meaning like one would be like 97.2,
right,
and one would be 98.3. You know, you never got sort of I was just wondering what that says about the overall. We're also trusting this technology of thermometers, which I don't know. Is the jury out on those, Jim, as to how accurate they are?
You know, it's another complicated one, Joe, and this is not...
All right, so let me ask you a question.
On, but the answer is they're taking averages, but, you know, most of the ones that are looking at it at temperature to distance rather than something you actually put in your mouth at length, you know, are affected by if you just got out of your car with air conditioning, have you been out in the sun, things like that, and they try to adjust for those.
But what about at 11?
Mm-hmm. So another example for using technology and it's not always reliably working is, have you ever been asked to, or have you ever put on a blood pressure cuff at a doctor's office?
Oh yeah, it's all over the place. But isn't that? But I always thought that was.
Work.
I thought it was white coat syndrome.
No, these things never work. The cuffs are widely swinging back and forth. I mean, it's just, these things are useless. The most reliable blood pressure measure is when you actually have somebody touching you and doing it as a professional.
Manually,
manually carried out. These, you know, sometimes the batteries are old or the thing was dropped, the cuff was dropped. You should never rely on these cuffs. They never give you reliable results. And we know these kinds of problems exist with technology.
Speaking of blood pressure, we're late for news, and that affects Ray's blood pressure. So we're going to take care of that. And
that's not hard to do.
No. We'll be. Are you feeling good, Ray? You good? Yeah. I got a thumbs up. Seems good. All right. We'll be back right after this. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Nice to have you with us. It is Thursday, the 14th of May, 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Jim Henler, Kate McGuire, and Vera Akarios-Kelly, we thank you all for being with us. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to a couple of letters, if that works for you all. Mary says, contact tracing is a basic part of public health to control communicable diseases, including HIV and other conditions that are transmitted sexually or through needle sharing. Contact tracing works even in settings where people are being asked to provide info about their sexual and needle sharing partners. It isn't perfect, but it is invaluable. That's a good point. A lot of this isn't perfect, but it is necessary.
Yeah, choices have to be made. No question about it. You know, personal information versus public good.
So Norm says, the people who I see at the recycling center in the store who can't seem to figure out how to wear a mask tend to be old guys. By the way, before you get mad at me, I'm an old guy. Old guys expect others to follow rules and laws, except if it inconveniences them. Example, Trump still not wearing a mask. Many of these same old guys likely do not have cell phones to trace and have no clue what an app is. Or what to do with one. If they had one, they have trouble with the basics like social distancing. So Norm setting us straight on that, and it's probably a
good
thing.
Wait a second. He's not setting us straight. I'm an old guy. I wear a mask. And I'm not. And I don't appreciate being lumped into a category with you-know-who.
Oh, well, that's true. I think he meant more. I was taking it more about the apps and such.
Oh, yeah. Well,
which I even feel greatly, you know, like I'm not exactly on, you know, knowing what I'm doing there.
Well, when Jim said we were talking about, you know, his app, I wanted to know what that app was. I
absolutely
get that app
pinging.
The problem with me is I can't find them. I got so many apps. And on so many pages, I don't know where anything is anymore.
Well, we have to put them in.
Well, this is a nice one because you just turn it on and then ignore it.
Yeah, and then it notifies you. And then it notifies you. Yeah. Speaking of notifications, we just have confirmed that, Alan, you'll be talking with Governor Cuomo live at 10:30 this morning. This will not be his briefing that we'll be going to. It'll be going to a live conversation between you and the governor at 10:30 this morning. So,
and we'll be playing it, right?
Oh, yeah. It'll be live.
Great,
yeah,
great,
absolutely.
Great,
yeah. Be live. Yeah. We'll be going to that. Now, what we don't know is when the governor's briefing is. So I think it's possible that you could be talking to him at 10:30 to 11, and then at 11:30 we'll go back to him doing a briefing. I don't know. But we'll find out. We know whatever it is, Alan, you're more important than doing the briefing. So that's great. That's very good.
No, I get it. I hear you. Yeah. There's no possibility, though, that my thing and the briefing will be on at the same time.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? That'd be great. Oh, God. I would race down to the Capitol to see that.
I was going to say the briefing's popularity would go way up.
Oh, my God. Alan, you need to be on CNN, please.
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
All right. Well, that's coming up. Always great conversations, and that'll be coming up at 10:30 this morning. We heard whispers a little bit, and now it's confirmed. So we'll look forward to that coming up at 10:30 this morning.
Yeah, the way that that worked was that Ian Pickus called me while we were talking, all of us. And instead of my...
Oh, in that case, those were literal whispers, yes. I didn't even mean that. I just meant around the building, but go ahead.
So instead of turning down the knob on my machine here that says to master control, I had the conversation with him for the Great Northeast at the same time.
Yeah, that's okay. It just gave us a little insight into the making of the sausage. It's all good.
It's the way it works.
Yeah. It is the way it works. I do. So that's very cool. So panelists, after 10:30, you get a snow day.
Thank you.
A snow half hour.
Right.
I'm to go for a drive outside.
Yes, go drive. And so Kate, the way I would like this to work then is I know you have a poem for us. So at about 10:25, we'll go to you on that, and then we'll wrap up. Does that sound good?
Lovely.
Okay.
Well, that would be if you went to a public college.
Yeah.
It would be poem.
Poem.
A poetic.
But if you went to a private college, it would be
Alan.
A poem. Poem. Poem.
All right. We go back to the letters. And Samuel writes, my wife and I work for nonprofits. She works from home. I'm in the field as an essential worker. Both organizations have public welfare in their missions, but neither acknowledges that parents just got an additional full-time childcare job since school and daycare have closed. We've even been told by management, oh, we're flexible. If you need to work at 1 a.m., feel free. When will society confront this dilemma? I feel like, especially with nonprofits, we're juggling staying relevant and staying solvent with martyrdom mentality and lack of empathy for parents and the well-being of our children, future, and members of society. I feel like those without young children can't relate. What do you think? I will say, Samuel, that I do not think this is a problem that is limited to nonprofits. I think this is a problem that is throughout, from what I hear from my wife, who works for a corporation, a company. Mm-hmm. This is a very prevalent problem. But I'm interested if anyone has anything to say about it.
Yeah, I got a question.
Yeah,
I got
go
a
ahead.
Question. What's the? Because I didn't quite get it. What exactly is the problem?
Meaning that they're not taking into account that because they're working from home, not taking into account that they now have this full-time job, which is childcare and also schooling. And so the way that they're working on it, the way that the companies and these two cases are the nonprofits, that they're saying, okay, well, we'll work with you on it. So if you can do your work at 1 a.m., that would be great. And the question was, at what
that
point?
That was sarcastic. That had to be sarcastic.
Well, not really. I mean, I don't, you know, I know. I've seen Kelly get up at midnight for calls, you know. I think, but what, and we don't have kids, thank goodness. But what I think is the actual question in there was, are we going to start adding that into the equation of how that is an issue for many people?
So I wanted to say something about unregulated work hours, and that is a significant problem that is emerging on this for those who are working from home now. So the expectation that you deal with family members, all kinds of problems within the household, you maintain your job, and if you can't get your work done during the regular hours, you just work at night, you work on the weekends, there's sort of no limit to, you know, there's no demarcation to the workday anymore. And I think this is a serious problem. We know that a lot of people have issues with sleep disruption, extreme stress, childcare related issues. And now I wanted to mention, now it, for me, it's not as difficult as for somebody who has smaller children or, kids in kindergarten or in middle school, perhaps, in terms of encouraging them to do online learning and helping them with their homework. But I, even though officially our semester is over, I still have a lot of students who are in contact with me because they have incompletes, because they have dealt with mental health issues, family issues. So this is broadly stated a significant problem in society. How do we address high levels of stress, sleeplessness, and this sort of overreach of the internet-based economy to sort of destroy family life and time to relax or exercise, I mean, or take a walk, because work is constant.
It can be, but I also think that a lot of us just look at it and say, just people in general just seem to look at it and say, well, okay, but thank God I have a job.
Exactly. Or how about it? All the people who say, I don't have a job. So, you know, this is a very tough time, obviously, for an awful lot of people.
It is. And it's a lot of juggling.
But I don't think it has to be a binary like that. Either you have a job and just keep quiet and deal with all the difficulties, or you don't have a job. I think that's a false choice. Why can't we have a discussion about creating jobs, having flexibility, and at the same time protecting families with smaller children or having some kind of support for families that need some help? I don't understand why it's either or. I think that's one of those very American arguments to me.
So there, I don't think it is either or. And I mean, there's tremendous amount of discussions going around about this stuff. Schools have actually been opened, particularly in New York City, as daycare centers for essential workers, with social distancing. But I think what really is going to be the most complicated issue here is we don't know how long this is going to go on for. So if it's going to be a few weeks and really we'll see a reopening, which may be the case in our region, then it's a temporary problem. And it's hard to say, let's make this major investment and change. The problem is many of us believe this is going to be something that's going to be with us. You know, the magic vaccine may or may not even come. And if it does, it's a long way off.
Well, and I think
so. We may be talking about something that has to become part of a new normal. And I think in that, we must take into account the stuff.
I think we have the point of the letter writer is that, make it part of the conversation, especially if we're going to talk about not sending kids back to school in the fall, which would be, that obviously something that would need to be part of the discussion. Let's go to...
By the way, talking about kids and yes, school, can I just do one quick brand? I would just like to say that my child's doctoral dissertation in linguistic anthropology at SUNY Albany has been accepted. So we will be among the parents not going to graduation this next few weeks. But yay, kid, Dr. Harowit Headley.
Well, sorry.
I know, it's a great accomplishment.
Sorry, your kid's a dummy.
Very good.
Yeah. Congratulations, Jim. That's really amazing. Good for you. All right. We got this from Kate, who says, I read in the news that China tried to hack an American lab that is working on developing a vaccine for COVID-19, but I'm wondering why the scientific communities globally aren't working together to develop a vaccine. This is a global pandemic. We should all be sharing our information in the hopes that we get a vaccine sooner. Well, most of the nations are working together, right? We're the ones that decided we wanted to go alone. Am I right on that?
You know, the answer is yes. There is a tremendous amount of stuff going on together, and a lot of it is supported by the U.S. The High Performance Computing Consortium is international, all sorts of great stuff. But there's tremendous amount of money to be made for whoever gets that vaccine first if you do it in a capitalist society. So in the U.S., you have yet again that tension between public good and private benefit, and that's just another way it plays out.
Let's go to another letter. And Patty, no, I'm sorry. We'll go to, I'm going to letters that I've already read and I don't know. Okay, Vicky, that's right, says, I do not recognize the USA. I'm sorry to say this. We have a president who acts like he's above the law and the Republican Party who supports him no matter what he does. Mass shootings, demonstrators toting weapons in states' capitol buildings, outward racism, and a Democratic Party who can't get their people out to vote even when all they have to do is mail in their ballot. Lots of issues here. I am disillusioned, says Vicky. Kate, is there anything you can do to help Vicky feel better?
Shall I move to Maya Angelou?
Yeah, sure. Do that now, and then we'll do some. Yeah, that would be great, actually.
I think it might help, actually. I think that, you know, if history is any indication, we'll get through this, but this is a tough time. We've been through them before. So Maya Angelou, at the inauguration of President Clinton and Vice President Gore, wrote the poem On the Pulse of Mourning, a beautiful poem. And when I'm on my early morning walks, so many passages come through my head as I'm looking at the gorgeous signs of nature. And the end of the poem seems particularly uplifting to me. I the rock, I the river, I the tree, I am yours. Your passages have been paid. Lift up your faces. You have a piercing need for this bright morning dawning for you. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, and if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Lift up your eyes upon the day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, men, take it into the palms of your hands. Mold it into the shape of your most private need. Sculpt it into the image of your most public self. Lift up your heart. Each new hour holds new chances for new beginnings. Do not be wedded forever to fear, yoked eternally to brutishness. The horizon leans forward, offering you space to place new steps of change. Here, on the pulse of this fine day, you may have the courage to look up and out upon me, the rock, the river, the tree, your country. Here, on the pulse of this new day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes, into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning.
Hmm. Yeah. Beautiful poem from Kate McGuire reading Maya Angelou's On the Pulse of Mourning. I talked to her once about that poem, and she told me, I asked her how she wrote it, and she said she went into a hotel room for 4 days, locked in the hotel with three items, a Bible, a dictionary, and a bottle of bourbon.
Wow. I think you've defined my new way of preparing class.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Thank you for sharing that, Kate. That was beautiful. And I think a very good answer to and maybe some help to Vicky's statement earlier. Let's see. Some quick letters here before we go to Alan and the governor coming up here.
We have this letter from Patty, who says, on a recent grocery shopping trip, I saw close to 10 people not wearing masks, all old white men. So back to Norm's theory. Sean says, how come no one on the panel has mentioned that Germany had 80% of their manufacturing still open this entire time? We always talk about how great the Europeans are handling this, but they kept 80% open. Do you want to tackle?
They kept 80% open, but they were very careful about what they kept open, how they kept it open, doing some testing. You know, they really did a very science-based thing. Now, some of it may have been over, but if you look at the numbers, we're doing a whole lot worse than they were, despite the fact that they managed to do that.
We go to...
go ahead. You remember, I was in Germany and... in mid-March, and we were in complete social isolation there with just a couple of family members, and, you know, there was no contact. No, you know, it was very carefully done, and factories that remained open, manufacturers reorganized their workstations completely.
We want to go to, just a couple more letters here. Bob says, this is short but not sweet. Economies recover, dead people do not. Something to keep in mind. Corona versus war? ? This is from Russell. Instead of the coronavirus being out there, what if it was bombs and missiles being rained down in the American public? Would protesters still want to go back to work? Greg says, regarding the theater, if you require masks, you don't need 6 feet, right? I don't know. Is that
yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you might not be breathing on each other, but there shouldn't be any touching. And, you know, you can spread the virus by touching chairs or touching each other. And then, you know, so for out of caution, you should not be any closer, even if you wear a mask.
And these masks are not by any means perfect. Some have spaces on the sides. Some people get it through the eyes. Come on.
Let's see. We have this letter from the panel. I'm wondering if your location services, maps, et cetera, are off. Can they still track you? So if they're off on your phone, can they still track you? If your phone is off, can you still be tracked? This is sort of creepy. Not that Snowden didn't warn us. Jim?
So there are technical barriers, there are legal barriers, there are many different things playing out in this space. It's a very, very complicated thing. In fact, one of our former panelists, I don't know if he's been on lately, Fran Berman, is on sabbatical. She's actually writing a book on all this. It's very, very complicated. But the fast answer is... there's certain things that can be tracked pretty much no matter what. There's other things that require your cooperation, and that's obviously going to be an issue. You know, on a campus, if we say, use this app, and a student says, gee, I don't want them to know I'm going to someone else's room. I'm just going to leave my phone in my own room. There's no way we can know that. So, again, that's why we don't think these things are a panacea. We think they're just a help for human contact tracing, which, as someone else, one of the letter writers pointed out before, is absolutely critical to returning to life after a pandemic.
Susan is looking to us for some guidance. She says, what are the current recommendations for shopping safely? What kind of personal protective gear, including hats, masks, gloves, wipes, Purell, are recommended? Does car need decontamination once you've been in a store and then sit in the car to drive home? Do you need to wash all the clothes you've worn in the store? And how to deal with groceries once they're home? If we're short of sprays like Lysol, how do we deal with fruits and vegetables and packages? There's a lot here. And each shopping trip seems to be a perilous adventure. Each package like a Trojan horse for COVID. A really good evidence-based answer to this would be helpful. Well, I don't know that we're qualified to give you an evidence-based answer, but I would say I know that the CDC and other organizations, right, Jim, have a lot of information available on these very questions.
Yep. And, you know, by and large, the fast answer is if you're gloved and masked. Yep.
But there's no too much. I mean, my daughter won't take the mail in for 3 days because people will have touched the mail.
Well,
I mean, you know, there gets to be a point of no return. I mean,
right.
Doesn't there?
Yes.
The information changes, though.
It's very
too.
Yeah, the information changes. But one of the things you can do if you have access to a garage, to leave items there for a couple of days. You know, if you don't have Lysol and you go shopping, you just leave your stuff in the garage, except for perishables, you know, that you can't do much about. You have to
All
bring
right.
it
what
in the house.
What about them perishables?
But All right. Wash your
and,
hands.
And finally, let's just say very clearly, soap is a very good thing against
yeah,
this
good,
particular coronavirus.
Very good friend.
Wash your hands when you get home. Wash your hands often.
All right. We have the governor on line 12, so I'm going to release all of you, except for Alan,
thank
who
you.
Is going to be put into service here. Thank you very much to Jim Henler, Kate McGuire, and Vera Carius Kelly. We'll be back with a conversation between the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, and Alan Chartok right after this.